Welcome to another episode of the Untangling Web3 podcast. Today, we're exploring one of the most important aspects of blockchain technology or cryptocurrencies, which is the consensus algorithms that underpin them. So these mechanisms effectively enable decentralized networks to agree on state or effectively what's going on in the ledgers that basically describe them. So this is how you add transactions, how you kind of agree on things, all without a central authority, which is kind of like the novel bit of all this stuff. So they're pivotal in differentiating between various blockchain platforms and at the heart of discussions about scalability, security, sustainability, all these types of things. So it should be an interesting episode today. How are you doing, Jack?
Yeah, I'm good. I've been excited to talk about this one for quite a long time. I'm surprised it's taken us this long, actually, to do an episode on it, because it is obviously one of the not most controversial topics, but one of the most kind of debated topics in all of blockchain and Web3, right? This is so fundamental to how blockchains work. So yeah, I think it's good to finally, you know, lay the groundwork for at least a few of them.
Yeah, I mean, just to like kick this off, I think when we think about, you know, what blockchains are, the simplest way to think of them in my mind is they're effectively Excel sheets where we have, you know, all a list of transactions on the entire history of, say, Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever it is. But the beauty of this in really simple terms is that many people hold copies of the same Excel sheet. But the tricky thing is there, if Jack, you know, myself and my mom all have the same copy of an Excel sheet, and then someone else adds a new transaction to that Excel sheet, how do we agree on how to add that transaction? Who adds it? When do we add it? When do we all confirm? And it sounds like really simple, you know, just save and it'll upload and all that kind of stuff. But when you're talking about, you know, big transactions, high volume, things moving quite quickly, then it actually does get quite complicated. And that is what consensus is, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's what's the point in a blockchain that stores all our, you know, our digital money, all these assets, NFTs that may be used for all sorts of other applications, you know, data type applications, if, you know, people are disputing, well, what's the actual historical record? We talk about blockchain as almost like a universal source of truth. And I'd say truth in quotation marks, because, you know, consistency doesn't mean truth. But for the purposes of this conversation, you know, what is the ground truth, the state, as you said, of the blockchain? It's crucial, because if you have, you know, we're talking about distributed networks. If different nodes think different things about the state of the chain, then maybe the network thinks Alec has the money that I should have, right, in my transaction. So yeah, it's a crucial aspect of blockchain. So, you know, why don't we talk about the fundamental problem that people talk about often when we say consensus algorithms, and that's the Byzantine generals problem, right? So this is really the starting point for designing consensus algorithms.
I know that you're always talking about the Byzantine generals problem, so I think this is your, like, you know, your party topic, so I think you can kick off.
Yeah, and obviously we talked about this with Kurt as well recently, so he's, if you know, if you haven't heard that episode, he probably has done a better job than I'm about to do. But essentially, the Byzantine generals problem is framed around this hypothetical group of Byzantine generals who are trying to decide whether or not to attack a nearby city or town or something like this. And they are distributed. So you can see the link already with blockchain. They are distributed in nature. So they're, you know, one's attacking from the west, one's attacking from the east, north, south, etc. They're all in their little encampments. Now, they need a way to decide on whether or not they should perform this attack. So, you know, maybe it's a bad day for it. Maybe there's bad weather. Maybe it's more fortified than expected. They need to work out how to communicate with one another such that they're either all going to attack or none of them are. And that's basically key to their success. So how do we ensure this consistent communication between these parties? And, you know, you have potential issues, you might have bad actors, you might have, you know, generals that don't want to attack. Maybe they think this is doomed to failure. I'm going to leave my garrison back and I'm going to let my people live, but the others can go ahead. But the problem is, if they don't all attack, they'll fail, right? So there's kind of two requirements to solve this problem. So one of them is consistency, and that's all the loyal generals, so all the good actors, should agree on the same decision. And if all the loyal generals, again, all the good actors, receive the same information, then they should all come to the same agreement, basically. So they should all reach the decision. They shouldn't have, you know, if they all get the same information, they should all kind of receive, they should all get the same opinion on whether to attack or not. That's the basic framing of this problem.
Exactly. And you know how we like to make things relatable to people at home, all the Byzantine generals out there who are listening. You've got a solution now to solve your method of attacks. No, I know this kind of is the way that it is described because people have been talking about this for hundreds, if not thousands of years, right? I think that one of the things to make it a bit more relatable to people today is in that example of us all having, you know, the individual Excel sheet and we're all trying to agree on what transactions, who's got what money, has Jack paid me, have I paid Jack, whatever, is there's this big problem we always talk about with currency and sending payments around double spending. If I have, you know, this £20 note physically, let's say digitally, and then I give it to Jack, I say, Jack, here's a £20 note for the good. And then I also try and give it to my mom, here's a £20 note, and I give it at the exact same time. How do we prove that, you know, Jack has the £20 note or my mom has the £20 note? Because there's this kind of, I guess, if it takes a long time to start processing things, there'll be this time that I'll receive two sets of goods and both people will think they've got the £20 before actual confirmation to say you have got the £20. So that's one way to make it relatable, this double spend problem and how to avoid fraudulent transactions.
Yeah, exactly. The equivalent of attacking the city is the state of all the accounts in the Excel sheet, right? Because, you know, if they're all wrong, we're going to have a very bad time. All our money is going to be all over the shop. So it's kind of equivalent to failure scenario in the Byzantine generals example.
If you are just tuning in, yeah, this is now a history podcast. No, just kidding. I think like fundamentally what this comes down to is trust, right? You said truth earlier, and I kind of think of it as trust. Everyone talks about blockchains as being like trustless systems, and we kind of defined it. What am I trying to say here? No, I'm not going to go down that railway thing that I talked about before. It's far too confusing. Not is that sense. these are more trustworthy systems, and the kind of the trust changes where the trust means that things are more visible. And when we're talking about people trying to interact without a central authority, it's actually really tricky to manage this trust, manage everything like in a kind of decentralized way. So yeah, that's the point of these consensus algorithms. They maintain trust in a kind of a trustless environment. And I guess as of 2023, there are over 10,000 active cryptocurrencies and many, I think there's hundreds of different consensus mechanisms. So trying to sieve through these to work out which ones you can trust and which ones you can't is an absolute nightmare. But we're going to go through some of the leading ones today and try and outline what they look like, what the pros are, what the cons are, and how they compare.
Yeah, exactly. And it's worth noting as well that these consensus algorithms are the subject of like really heated academic discussion, not just kind of engineering technical stuff from the people building blockchains. But, you know, there are some serious academics who have proposed these different consensus algorithms over the years, and that also feeds into it. But yeah, as you said, there are so many different ones out there. Typically, they'll follow the naming convention proof of something. And the reason for that is the kind of the OG, the original one, as we always say, goes back to Bitcoin, which came out with its own algorithm that was really touted as the first practical solution to the Byzantine generals problem in the context of kind of digital ledgers, digital Excel sheets. And that was proof of work, right? So this was the one of the key innovations that spawned Bitcoin from Satoshi.
Yeah, I mean, that happened back in 2008, right? And you kind of said that there were things going around before that, but this was one of the practical examples where people started to get buy-in. And this has been going now for, what, over 14 years, 16 years now? And it's probably the most battle-tested, well-known consensus algorithm going. I don't think there's been any downtime or any like major malicious attacks that have been successful in that time. And Bitcoin obviously manages trillions of dollars, and people are now institutionally buying into this fact and starting to trust this system. So, should we try and outline how proof of work actually works?
Let's go for it. I mean, this is one where we might have a bit of debate on how to describe it. I know we did with Kurt previously. So, essentially, with proof of work, the whole idea is how do we ensure this consistent communication, this consistent signal between our nodes on the network? And Satoshi's idea was to attach a costly signal or a computational cost to this message, to the idea of adding new blocks. So if you want to add transactions to the blockchain, to your spreadsheet, then you need to have this additional computational cost attached to that message to prove that some work has been done, to sink some work into doing this, right? So sometimes this is called a mathematical puzzle. I don't love to call it that, but it is illustrative of what it is. So essentially, it's like a guess and check system. So you're going to repeat this hash, this computation, many, many times. So you're going to take this new set of transactions that you want to add to the ledger. You're going to perform this hash function over it, or you're going to basically compute this function, this very simple dumb function essentially that spits out a random number, and you're going to check if that random number meets a requirement. And we can get into what the actual requirement is, but you're going to do that over and over and over and over and over again until you finally hit one that meets the requirement. And then if it does, that's the condition, then you can say, great, I can go and communicate out to the network, to my generals of Bitcoin nodes, and say, here, I've got a solution, I can add a block to the network, and then they can verify this computation that you've done very easily as well.
Yeah, I think you've described it very nicely there. Is you basically, I mean, a lot of them are reliant on this hash function, the stupid function that you've talked about, where you can throw in data and you get a unique, unpredictable representation of that input data. So the data that's being inputted is, like we talked about, the transaction data, some other data. Basically, you get a unique representation of that transaction data. So all the transactions that are in that block, the updates to the ledger we talked about, and the Excel version of the file. And then something called a nonce, which is effectively a random number that you try and get the unique representation post hash of all that data below a certain threshold. And we don't really need to talk too much about, you know, what the threshold is, but it's just you're trying to get a unique representation that's below a certain number effectively. And that's kind of how the work is computed. And like Jack said, the kind of the big paradigm shift here is, you know, previously when we had central authorities like banks or something like that managing the transactions, and they would do everything, you're trusted in the bank, or you trust that their single version of the Excel file is the kind of the holy grail and everyone goes to that single version. Whereas now with Bitcoin, we're trusting in the hash power, the people that are computing this mass amount of hashes to do these kind of transactions. You're trusting in their hash rather than their physical identities. But I mean, you could say that you also know who they are as well, and there is some identity based stuff in there.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of things to point out about this dumb hash function as well, right? So as you said, this unique representation, sometimes called a digital fingerprint. So it's like this uniquely identifies the input data, i.e. the block you're trying to produce. It's also effectively random as well. So how do you repeat this over and over again? As you said, you take the data for the block that's kind of static, and then you add this nonce in. That's the bit that differentiates this hash. And then you can, you know, try it once, doesn't get the right answer. Then we change that nonce, that number only used once. And you just repeat that process over and over and over again. So it effectively produces a random new output that may or may not meet that criteria every single time. And the other kind of crucial part then is that, okay, what does that really solve? Well, this needs to happen in conjunction with the difficulty adjustment algorithm, right? So this is the part that makes it competitive in nature, right? That means that, you know, everyone is competing to try and find a solution, and the difficulty adjustment algorithm is constantly making sure that there's a sufficient amount of energy or computation that has to happen to send one of these signals. Because if it was really easy, then it wouldn't really solve anything, right? It would just be, you know, we can all do it instantly and we'd all come to this same problem of, well, everyone's got a solution, they're all different, we're not in agreement anymore, right?
Exactly. So the point is, the entire network, all these many miners, they get, say, similar transaction history. Once they've got their transactions, they start putting them into a block, and that's effectively trying to get compute this value of the hash with this random number to get it below a certain threshold. As soon as they've done it, like their computation with the random number is below that threshold, they say, bingo, I've done it, I've solved it first, and they send it out to the other miner saying, look, I've got a hash value now with the random number and the transaction data that's below the threshold. I'm the first to solve it. Give me the money. And one of the kind of the key points here is it's very difficult to do, but it's very easy to verify. So very quickly, all the other miners who are still trying to compute this block can say, oh yeah, verification done. They have done it. They get the rewards. We're now going to build on top of their block and start propagating the network further. Or you can say, actually, no, you've done it wrong. And I can verify that very quickly as well. So I'm going to keep trying to mine that block. So this kind of brings in the incentive part as well, where whoever does it first, they get Bitcoins. We've kind of done previous episode about how many Bitcoins they get and the number going down every few years. But yeah, that's how the reward mechanism comes into this as well.
Yeah, number go down, which is not the best thing in crypto normally, but actually is the thing that underpins it all. But yeah, that is really crucial what you said there. You sometimes call these trapdoor functions, and the hash function that you're computing is one of these trapdoors. So it's hard to compute. This problem is hard to solve, to find a valid solution that satisfies the criteria. But yeah, once you found it, you have to all you have to do is tell everyone what inputs you use, and they can verify instantly. They only have to compute the hash once, whereas you may have done it, you know, billions of times in order to get your solution. So that's kind of the key there. And then, yeah, this block reward is the other part. So we say all the time how Bitcoin combined, you know, computer science and economics and game theory into one thing. And this is, you know, in the proof of work consensus algorithm, that's where it's most obvious, I think, because you have the computational thing, you have this trapdoor function that you're hashing over and over again. But then you have the game theory, the incentive side of it, where everyone's competing to do it first. And then the final little piece of the jigsaw puzzle is the fact that you have the difficulty adjustment algorithm that's making it sufficiently hard all the time. So, you know, it's not just we're going to be running into problems all the time.
Yeah, and we're talking about like the amount of work you have to put in this difficulty algorithm that's basically forcing miners to do lots of high energy tasks to produce these blocks that says this is, you know, the new state of the network. These are the transactions that have been validated. And that's one of the main parts of the security mechanism is this is very high energy and there's high equipment costs that would deter malicious actors to do this. And another big component of this is, you know, once I've built my block, when I'm building the next block, I actually build on top of that block. And what we kind of, I don't want to go into too much detail on this, but you're effectively having a hash, the unique hash of the previous block built into your current block's hash as well. And that in this way creates this blockchain, this chain of blocks. And the point here is if I'm doing lots of work in block one to create that, and then I do lots of work in block two to create that, and then lots of work in block three, obviously, when I'm like linking these together, effectively, if I want to change a transaction in block one, and we're now at block four, I have to recompute, do all that high intensity, high energy stuff for all those subsequent blocks as well for them to be valid. Like we said, that's very hard to do, very easy to verify. So when we kind of talk about Bitcoin, we have this previous idea around, you know, your transaction is not safe until you've got, you know, 10 blocks that are built on top of this. That used to be under this kind of assumption that it's so high energy intensive, the further back you go, that it's almost physically, well, I'd say very impractical to do it. Don't know if that's true anymore, because actually the amount of energy that goes into even the previous block is so high these days that it'd be very difficult to do that anyway. But yeah, that's one of the assumptions that's part of this.
Yeah, that's a really good point, right? Because going back to the original problem that we're solving, when you talk about Bitcoin being secure using proof of work, we talk about it in terms of 51% secure, or it's secure against 51% attack. So it basically says if you have more than half of the nodes on the network honest, so more than half of my generals are good generals that are acting in good faith and honestly, then
seeing the Napoleon Bonaparte part of you there, are they good generals, are they acting honestly?
Yeah, let's not get into all that, because that's gonna be a huge rabbit hole. But yeah, the condition being the network will be secure if you have at least half of the field of your generals and your participants are honest. And as you said, it's not just a single block. You're building up the work throughout successive blocks. So you can actually measure how much work is behind a chain instead of just a single block. And the deeper that chain, the more work that has to be done to overcome it, right? So the idea of the 51% security being, so long as more than half of the generals are good, then they can outpace any attacker. So if any attacker tries to, you know, build an alternative chain, well, so long as they don't have half of that hashing power or more, then the honest people will always together be able to build on the main chain. And you can actually, they talk about this in terms of following the heaviest chain. So the heaviest chain being the one that has the most work attached to it, the most compute that's been done. But it's kind of interesting, because when you look at, you know, how much hash power has grown over the whole lifespan of Bitcoin, those early blocks are nothing, right? You could actually speed run the first, you know, few hundred thousand blocks of Bitcoin with today's equipment relatively quickly. But it's that last few thousand or last 10,000, 100,000 blocks that where it becomes really, really heavy, because each of those blocks has more work associated with it than, you know, many, many of the early blocks of Bitcoin. So that's kind of interesting as well to think of. You could try and forge an old part of the chain, but you couldn't get very far with it.
Yeah, like you said, the obvious pro that you just identified is the proven security. Like Bitcoin and proof of work has been going there for 16 years, and there's been, you know, that's over a decade of secure operation. Like, what is it called? Almost zero downtime, no malicious hacks, no kind of suspended periods of people trying to actually, you know, produce these bad malicious blocks. So that's a big pro. Like kind of Kurt described it as completely bomb proof, or I've heard a few people describe it as completely bomb proof. If there's a nuclear disaster and everything goes wrong, Bitcoin will still still keep going and no one will be able to hack into Bitcoin after that or something like that. And we actually talked a little bit about the quantum episode. Actually, no, we're not going to go down that rabbit hole. But if you are interested into knowing how some ways in which Bitcoin could be vulnerable, maybe go back to our quantum episode, because that's a whole rabbit hole that we're not going to go down right now.
Yeah, rabbit holes on rabbit holes. We're kind of going into some other wormhole or something now. But yeah, and proof of work, there have actually been, I mentioned the academic credentials of proof of work and other consensus algorithms. There have been some academic attacks on proof of work saying, well, in theory, it could be vulnerable to this kind of attack. There's a kind of selfish mining attack that's mentioned as well. But in practice, as you said, there's never really been any issue of this nature. There's such an incentive to attack the network that you also have to remember. So that huge uptime is, you know, proves it's very secure, but coupled with the fact that of how many assets and the value of those assets that are secured by Bitcoin, the incentive to attack it is so high that also kind of proves in practice how secure it is. So yeah, we haven't really seen anything else like it. The other kind of, I guess, benefits of this are, I always think of it as like decentralization of the network is more an emergent property of this consensus algorithm than it is a design goal necessarily. So because it's competitive, it means you're always going to have multiple miners always competing, right? There's so much money on the table to collect with this subsidy, the 6.25 currently Bitcoins plus the fees, that you're always going to have people trying to compete. And that's kind of made it, you know, secure in practice, right? That's why you're never going to have it all coalesce into one, because then the whole value of the system will be slightly undermined, right? So that's another big pro in the proof of work box in my book.
Yeah, one of the things I've read as well is that because the margins are so tight between these people, these miners competing to mine the next block, is they're always trying to improve their equipment, always trying to reduce their latency, always trying to improve their connections in the network. I mean, that's in theory, I guess, to try and mine the blocks as quickly as possible and get the rewards. But then in practice, when you look at like the performance criteria of Bitcoin, outside of just the security stuff, just about the, not just the energy required to make these blocks, but in terms of like, you know, throughput, scalability, blah, 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 all the things that we kind of, you know, actually compare blockchains with numbers, like it's not doing that well, right? It's still this kind of slow laggard that does the job very well, super secure, but, you know, isn't kind of hitting the throughput that we're seeing on some of the other chains. So that's one of the, you know, pro/con. The kind of the obvious con that is always thrown in the media is obviously the amount of energy consumption that goes into this. And this is kind of, you know, it's been compared to the energy consumption of Argentina, the energy consumption of Sweden, blah, 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 all these kind of massive numbers that are always out there. And like we always say on this, energy consumption in itself isn't a bad thing, but it's energy for the utility that it produces. And there's always questions around, you know, what utility does Bitcoin actually provide for society right now? And that's still a question mark in my mind.
It's not the pure idea of consumption that's the issue. It's the what do you get as a result, right? And for me, it's also a bit of an open question as to how much energy do you need to make it secure. It's because it's this dynamic thing. The difficulty adjustment algorithm is constantly changing how much hash power, how much compute power, how much energy by proxy is actually needed. You know, there's not necessarily anything to say that everyone could collectively reduce their energy and it still be secure. But it's then if some other malicious bad general actor pops up with loads of energy, then it might look insecure for a short while, right? So the security is a very dynamic thing in Bitcoin, and that's why I think it's hard to pin the finger on exactly, you know, how much energy do we need, should we be consuming it. But you're right, like you're completely right. It's if it's proving itself via utility, no one would be asking the question, right? If this was being used daily as a monetary system, if people were making payments in it day in, day out, people would not be questioning it, because you know, it's on a reasonable order of magnitude of energy to other global systems, except right now it isn't achieving that. So yeah, that's probably the biggest sticking point it's got.
Just on the point, because we kind of have to give both sides, right? Like on the energy debate, like it is using lots of energy. The one thing I would just want to say is that it's something like over 40%. I think it's actually over 50%. And so I've seen some stats around over 60% of Bitcoin mining does come from renewable energy sources. And like, you know, the hardcore environmentalists will say, well, that's renewable energy that could should be going to something more useful. And the retort to that is typically, well, you know, the point of Bitcoin is we can shove one of these mining rigs in the middle of the Arctic where, you know, this energy is kind of completely isolated and there's no real practical use for it outside of these Bitcoin mining rigs. But that's just to give both sides of the argument. I'm not sure how I fall on that. But yeah, a lot of this energy being used is renewable based.
Yeah, 100%. And I, for the record, I think it should all be. I have always maintained the position that I think Bitcoin is the first technology that is truly self-incentivizing people to use green energy, right? Because it has an associated upfront cost to build, you know, say your own renewable energy infrastructure as a Bitcoin miner. Because again, we're talking about big, big institutions now, like lots of public companies or companies of that kind of magnitude that are these mining operations, these mining pools. So it's not infeasible they can go and build their own electricity production things. We've seen in El Salvador them, you know, looking into co-locating mining rigs with geothermal energy, right? Which makes perfect sense. And because once you've made that initial investment, you're being paid for all that energy you produce via the Bitcoin reward system, then it's kind of a direct incentive to use it. And as you said, it could be used for energy that's otherwise going to waste that can't be transported from different sites. But yeah, it's always going to be a big talking point when you've got people like Greenpeace threatening to kind of sue people and lobbying for change, right? Because that happened, I think, last year or the year before. They were lobbying to change the consensus algorithm. So yeah, there are some big enemies of it right out there.
Yeah. So in that, you just talked about mining pools as well. That's one of the big kind of cons, I would say, around Bitcoin, is because to compete, you do need these really high spec bits of equipment. Like, you can't just, you know, spin out your laptop and try and like start mining Bitcoin. They are very specialist, large bits of kit that are usually based in, like, say, random areas that are kind of low energy costs, green related, hopefully like Alaska or something like that. You kind of have these pooling operators. The point is that people will contribute their energy to one mining pool and then effectively like distribute the hashing power. So rather than one PC doing everything, they'll kind of like shard it or distribute it or parallelize it. So you can have a million different people with their tiny little laptops all contributing to one mining pool that will then try and get the difficulty of the block being mined under a certain value, and then they share the rewards afterwards. The downside of that is, like, on paper, you could say I've got a million people all actually mining this network, but in reality, you've got one orchestrator there that's kind of a centralization point. And we are seeing that, even though online you might see the Bitcoin Core has, like, you know, thousands of different mining nodes. Really, I think it's like actually run by, say, up to 10 kind of actual mining pools. And it's like, yeah, there's a centralization potentially there.
Yeah. And the only thing I'd add to that, because I agree, it's, you know, whether or not that level of centralization is a problem is another question, I think. But mm-hmm. for those that care deeply about a high degree of decentralization, it's clearly an issue. And it's partly because those mining pool operators, they control the contents of the block. So the hashing operators, they just get to contribute energy. They don't really control what goes into the block, right? So you have a kind of single decision maker. My final point in defense of proof of work, which, you know, I think is fair enough, is that it's just very elegant, isn't it? Compared to some of the other solutions out there, right, which we'll get onto, I think it's so simple, and it's much easier to understand, and you can see very clearly how it solved the problem. And that's borne out by the popularity of Bitcoin, how much it's grown, and the fact that, you know, 15 years on, it still has this kind of robustness. But, you know, with that in mind, let's move on then to the other proof of X, right? Proof of what? What's the next one we should do? I think I know which one you're going to want to cover, Alex.
I think I know. It's proof of stake, right? When you look at, like, say, the top 50, top 100 blockchains, the vast majority of them are now proof of stake, which when I checked before this episode, I was kind of blown away by, because almost all of them are proof of work like 10 years ago. So proof of stake, obviously, you know, this is a big landmark event that Ethereum's been talking about for, I don't know, like 6 years. How long were they proposing the merge between, like, their testnet version of the proof of stake Ethereum and then the mainnet version of proof of work Ethereum? Like, this has been going on for absolutely ages. But the point is, now Ethereum is proof of stake based. Ethereum, as you know, is kind of like the second biggest by market cap blockchain, hosts thousands of decentralized applications, has probably the biggest developer community by far. So Ethereum is like the top dog in a lot of ways when we talk about the growth, utility, all these kind of words. Ethereum has around 14,000 nodes, and they're running 1 million validators. So how the hell is that possible?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And, you know, in the run up to the merge, which was in 2022, I think around September, there was this long period of people basically adding themselves as eligible to become a validator in this new model, right? So that you had to lock up, I can't remember how many it was. It was something like, is it like 16 ETH or something? I'd have to double check, but it was something not insignificant as an amount of money to lock up to become a validator for this new consensus algorithm for the network when it shifted. And, you know, one of the most notable things for me is that the fact that Ethereum was able to migrate from proof of work to proof of stake like that in and of itself was a huge technical achievement. The fact that it didn't really go wrong for all intents and purposes, I think, is amazing. But yeah, we should definitely get into how proof of stake actually works. So what's the current state of you know, how things are validated in Ethereum. So I'm gonna pass this one to you, Alec, because I did the first one, so now you can have a shot.
You did the very elegant one that you fancy. Yeah. I think so yeah, Jack talked about, you know, the point of decentralized networks, we're trying to agree on consensus what the state is. When you have a centralized point, obviously they can make all the decisions, but in Bitcoin we kind of trust miners' ability to kind of hash, which is effectively the amount of energy they consume. Whereas when we look at Ethereum and proof of stake, what you're trusting is the amount of stake they put into the networks, the amount of money. So Jack said, I think the actual cap currently is, to be a validator on Ethereum, you have to have 32 ETH. And that's what, 32 ETH, it's about $3,000 right now. So around 100K, let's say. So you will have 100K of the network tokens that are locked up. And that is your, say, basically your input to the network to say, I am trusted. I am part of this. If, you know, if the ship goes down, I go down with it. So that's their way of saying, okay, you are securely part of this network and you wouldn't want to be a malicious actor. The protocol then goes around these, you know, 1 million validators and will randomly select every few seconds. The Ethereum will effectively randomly select one of those 1 million validators with a 32 ETH locked up and ask them to validate the next block. Now, rather than doing this high intensity energy process that we talked about, proof of work, the validation here is effectively, I will just validate the transactions. I will look through them kind of in like a centralized way at that point of time and say, is this right? Do they make sense? I'll mine them effectively. And then everyone else will check my work. And, you know, the more in the kind of this system, the more tokens you stake, obviously the higher chance that you are selected, because it's this random selection based on all the stakes. And this, you know, this randomization, the minimum staking requirements of 32 ETH is meant to prevent any single entity kind of dominating the network.
Yeah, that's a lovely, lovely succinct description, Alec. It was just not easy to do, because, you know, the first thing I would note about it is that proof of stake, you know, surprise, surprise, I don't think it's quite as elegant in a way, because it has a few more moving parts, right? It has your block proposer and then your validators, which are kind of both being selected in proportion to that stake. And, you know, that's the equivalent of in proof of work, where we had your probability of mining a block is proportional to how much of this compute power you have, how much of this hardware you've amassed, whether it's on your own or in a pool. In Ethereum, it's how much money you've got locked in, right? So you don't have to have a massive data center operation to be involved. You just have to be rich, right? You just have to have a lot of tokens. So either you bought Ethereum when it was really cheap, or you have enough of the fiat currencies of the world to buy enough to stake now. And then, yeah, as you said, there are lots of other elements involved with securing proof of stake, right? So, you know, there are some issues associated with it. Maybe we'll get into, you know, what makes it secure. In terms of the Byzantine General's problem, it's kind of analogous to proof of work, though. It's doing a similar job by saying, well, so long as we have a majority of the money being honest, a majority of the stake locked up being honest, then it should be secure. But there are some issues, because you don't have that same immutability type property with Bitcoin, because there is no energetic cost now to faking a chain. You can create an alternative chain without any energy cost, right? You just have to sign a different version of things, which you could do quickly if you had enough money.
Yeah, I think one of the big points here is kind of related to the malicious actor versus, say, if one of the five Bitcoin nodes drops off the network, you still have the other four constantly competing. And if, say, I drop off, it doesn't matter, because four other people are going to mine that block almost as quickly. Whereas in Ethereum, obviously, because we have this random selection, I can lock up my stake, my Ethereum stake. And if I suddenly drop off the network and I'm randomly chosen as the person who's proposing the next block, well, you know, the block doesn't get mined effectively. And they obviously have this kind of backup program. If you don't respond in a couple of seconds or whatever it is, then you it'll go to someone else and someone else will be proposed and they'll mine the block. But they also have this idea now, because you have this stake locked up, if you don't say hit the minimum requirements of I will be online all the time, I will mine the block within this time, then they start to slash your stake. They'll say, okay, well, you're not a very good validator. You haven't hit our T's and C's. So now I'm going to slash your stake by 50%, all the way up to 100%. And this also kind of fits in with the malicious actor thing you were talking about. If, say, someone accidentally or purposefully, doesn't really matter, validates a wrong transaction somehow or tries to mine a block that isn't valid, then that stake will be invalidated as well. And this is kind of done in the separate stage you talked about. We have the proposer, then we have an attester that's randomly selected, then we have a finality thing, which is lots of people all attesting that the block is done. So it is much more complicated than Bitcoin. But that's how they kind of have this redundancy and checks. But this is enabled basically with the biggest cryptographic developer community in the world. So it's incredibly complex, but it also means that they really do have, like, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of different validators all properly contributing to a network. It is much harder to describe because there's so many different layers, but they are advancing so quickly and it is quite impressive what they're doing.
Yeah, 100%. There's very good reason for it being widely adopted, you know, apart from the fact that that lack of energy requirement means that it's much more attractive for, you know, big business and governments to start building on, right? Because you don't have that question or worry over how much energy it's consuming. There are then, as you said, questions over the security model. You have to introduce slashing to stop bad behavior, or maybe not even malicious behavior, but just being idle, right? And not actually being available when you need to be to validate or propose, etc. on the network. It's a kind of much more akin to just putting your money in the bank and getting a return on it, right? Because we should mention with proof of stake, typically you're putting this token in and you're getting rewarded in that same token for doing so. So it's almost like earning interest on the staked money that you have in there, the staked tokens. And then when you add in these different layers, you know, typically when we talk about security and computer science, the more complex it is, the bigger the attack surface, the more unknown unknowns you might be introducing to have to worry about in the security model. And we also know that, as with all blockchains, you know, proof of stake blockchains like Ethereum and others are also heavily investing in these layer two scaling solutions, which are adding more complexity, more layers to that problem. Now, and even though there hasn't been kind of, I would say, major breaches of proof of stake that we know of, I think I've seen more kind of academic theories about how they could be breached. So yeah, I think it's worth noting again that complexity is potentially a worry, but we haven't seen it in practice too much yet.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, like I said, Bitcoin's been around for 16 years now, but I think, like, the number of chains that are now deploying proof of stake, you kind of have, like, them in parallel, all kind of testing it out in different ways. But you are right, it's incredibly complex, but it does mean that they have a kind of, well, it's not just because of, say, the consensus algorithm, it's also because of all the things they're doing on top of that consensus algorithm, that it is incredibly complex, like the Ethereum virtual machine that basically allows programmability. Like, there's lots of more complex things that also feed into why it's so complex, right? It can't just be done in the way that Bitcoin is. But it does have faster block times. It does have higher TPS. I would say there are lower barriers to entry, which is good. But you are right, it is effectively money in, money out. But, you know, the world runs on money, fortunately or unfortunately. So it kind of is the thing that we're all used to. It does make sense. And like you say, the big thing when people think Bitcoin is high energy, slow, but very secure. And Ethereum's a bit more versatile, but yeah, a bit quicker as well, maybe.
Yeah, that's why we kind of, people refer to Bitcoin as this, like, super secure settlement layer, and Ethereum is more like a smart contract platform, right? It's more active in its processing. I think it's worth also noting the differences between proof of work and proof of stake in terms of that centralization risk you mentioned, because where in Bitcoin and proof of work, you tend to have maybe moving towards a small number of these pools or companies that act as the decision makers effectively, right? Maybe it's around 10 in Bitcoin. They're much more visible, I think, than in proof of stake systems, because again, in either Bitcoin or Ethereum, there's no identity system natively there. You don't need to identify yourself to participate in mining. You never have done in mining proof of work or being a validator in proof of stake. But if you're a proof of work miner, it's much harder to hide, right? You have to have one of these huge data centers. You have a pretty big electricity bill, right? It's harder to hide and they're much more easily identifiable. With Ethereum, all you need is to associate this amount of Ethereum with your wallet address and then your validator, right? How do we know that, say, the top 10 wallets in Ethereum aren't controlled by the same entity underneath it all, right? And I think that's one of the bigger concerns I have with it in general.
Yeah, I would agree with that point. I think that maybe pooling kind of undermines that argument a little bit because, like you say, if a million people are all contributing their laptops all around the world, yeah, you still need a data center to process transactions and manage all that, but it's much smaller than, say, the assumption that it's one giant center with all the ASICs in the world basically mining this stuff. I would say that, you know, in the same way that banks also don't have high computational power, but they have lots of people that are servicing the moving of assets, I imagine that pooling solutions as well also probably have that, you know, degree of trust. I'm not just going to throw my 32 ETH to anyone. I'm probably going to prefer, you know, someone that's got a bit of credibility behind them. But yeah, I do take your point. Like, the hardware does make it easier to track people than just money. But like I say, the world runs on money. But the big thing here is, like, you know, we're kind of questioning the utility of Bitcoin and everyone says hold the value, blah, blah, blah. No one can question the utility of Ethereum. Like, it is the place to build apps. It is the place where, you know, there are 15,000, you know, active developers constantly on the project. Like, it is the place where everything's happening. Everyone who's anyone, I'm not going to say, maybe not anyone, everyone is anyone. It's too big a statement. But, you know, the vast majority of people do build an EVM. They do build in Solidity. They know about the programmability. That's what's being taught in universities. Like, there's just so much happening there. It's like, it's such a, you know, good liveness check.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird situation, isn't it, where proof of work underpins the biggest, most well-known blockchain, but proof of stake is like the standard for the industry, right? So you have this very strange situation where you have the one outlier with all the history that has this proof of work, really, but then everything else has kind of almost moved on and gone to the next generation. So yeah, it's interesting to see how that will play out in the future. You know, I think we've covered nicely the main properties then of both proof of work, proof of stake, and compared them a little bit. Shall we have a kind of quick honorable mentions of some other versions of these or other consensus algorithms just to round things off?
Yeah, let's do it. Another one which is very, very closely linked to proof of stake is the idea of delegated proof of stake. So the only minor adjustment here is, you know, token holders, rather than individually validating themselves, can kind of offset that or delegate that kind of that power to one person. So the point here is, you kind of, rather than having a million validators, which is, like we said, extremely complicated to manage all those validators and all their inputs and randomly select and whatnot, you could, each of you, 1 million people, all of you vote for, say, one person out of 100. You decrease the validators, the number of validators, which makes it much easier to actually manage the network, manage the blocks, manage all the interactions. You still have the same amount of stake that's actually being staked in there, but much easier to manage. So that's one, you know, slight minor modification on proof of stake, is the idea of delegated proof of stake.
Exactly. So that is, yeah, one of the major variants that we're seeing more and more, and it kind of gives a bit more flexibility generally to proof of stake. And I think that one's, you know, gained a lot of popularity in the last couple of years, even though Ethereum's only just moved to proof of stake. Other things have started natively with DPoS.
The main reason there is because when you're talking about proof of stake networks or stake-based networks, is the amount of stake you have that's actually being, you know, staked as part of the validation is effectively the security profile. Like, the more stake you have on there, you assume the more secure the protocol. So some big malicious actor cut from North Korea can't just come in and say, you know, I've got enough money now to overthrow and over 51%. So like, it's important to have lots of stake, but lots of stake when you have like a low barrier to entry like Ethereum means you have to coordinate so many different people, so many different validators. So the main point of delegated proof of stake is you still have the same amount of stake, but you're kind of minimizing the number of people and they all vote for, say, one in 100 people to actually kind of manage the transactions, which makes it much easier from an operational perspective. And, you know, they tend to have, you know, higher transaction throughput, but maybe there's a risk of centralization there.
And I think this is very analogous to the mining pools in proof of work, right, that we said. So it's like people pooling resources together, except in that case, it's computational resources. Here, it's kind of financial token resources. And it's much more liquid. Again, there's variants of DPoS now, right, but kind of liquid proof of stake as well, where you can much more easily change who you're staked against, right? So the person you've delegated your stake to, you can switch up much more easily if something goes wrong or if you don't want to, a bit like the slashing we said before. So yeah, that's one of the big major alternatives. Another one would be proof of authority, which we've spoken about a little bit on the show before. You know, things like VeChain, TomoChain, these all use proof of authority, and that's kind of almost bridging that gap or that issue I mentioned with, you know, who is actually controlling this stake under the hood. You have much more kind of a sense of known identity and verification in the validator set of proof of authority, right? So these are more likely to be kind of reputable known entities that have to be kind of permissioned in to the network, as I understand it. And it's quite limited in number. So it's almost like a hybrid of all those models we've mentioned, but it has kind of some similar properties, right? You have these assigned turns between validators. You have very quick consensus typically. And a lot of the, you know, part of the security mechanism is actually also based on like reputation risk, because those validators that come into the network, they have a reputation at stake, right, as well. So in addition to, you know, any other resources
reputation at stake, juxtaposition there, let's not get confused. Yeah, you are right. So like the proof of authority is kind of like, in my mind, a web 2.5 kind of approach, where you still have these somewhat known entities that are kind of doing the validation or the mining or whatever you want to call it, but they're also doing it in a kind of more transparent way. So they're all managing their own versions of it, but you know who those parties are. So I imagine like, and it's much more enterprise friendly, because, you know, who's the, you know, the if you said that the Ethereum validator down the road, I don't know who they are, but I know who a PwC is, right? Or I know who a, you know, big company Walmart is or something like that. So it sits somewhere in between. My understanding is obviously VeChain as well. They also have a staking mechanism. So you are like a signed off individual. So there's the proof of authority where your reputation's at risk. Everyone knows you have to get signed off, but you also have a stake in there as well. So you wouldn't, you know, suddenly get signed off and then just start burning whatever the VeChain tokens are for that. So yeah, there's, like you say, probably a bit more friendly towards enterprises, higher throughput, less on the decentralization risk, because you have to sign off and you have these authorities that are in between, but, and there's maybe regulatory risks around that.
Yeah, exactly. I think you kind of touched on that good old chestnut, the blockchain scalability trilemma there as well, right? Like we always talk about, well, do you sacrifice security or decentralization or scalability? And each of these consensus algorithms, as we've kind of mentioned throughout, they tend to have a slightly different profile of each of those things. You also mentioned burning there, right? Proof of burn is another consensus algorithm that's kind of weaved its way into the consciousness now as well, where you kind of doing something similar to what we described, but you're actually burning tokens when you validate blocks. And there's actually an element of that in Ethereum now as well, right? Because fees get burned when you mine blocks. So that's an interesting one. Another one is proof of history, which, you know, Solana has risen to become one of the major chains over the last few years. And Solana's is interesting because it does take quite a different approach. Like its consensus mechanism, proof of history, has these things called verifiable delay functions. So where Bitcoin had this computational puzzle, let's call it again, there's a slightly different cryptographic puzzle or technique used where it's actually got a concept of time. So solving for the next block that creates the blockchain will be a kind of standard amount of time away. And this proof of history builds up using these special verifiable delay functions where, you know, if there's a solution, there's been X amount of time added on. So it's very interesting. But again, one I probably know a bit less about as a purist of proof of work.
Yeah, and I think everyone knows about Solana. They're achieving like absolutely crazy transaction throughput, like 65,000 transactions per second, which is obscene numbers, actually starting to compete with like traditional kind of fiat systems, which is a bit bonkers when you think about how low the numbers are for Bitcoin and Ethereum. But you know, like you said, it's very complex. I think Solana is also known for a lot of network outages, which isn't good. And like I said, it's something that we're not going to dive into in any depth in this episode because it's a bit too complex for us. So in this episode, we've talked about, you know, consensus algorithms, why they're needed, why they're so important, and some of the main differences between the big ones: proof of work, proof of stake, proof of authority, proof of history, delegated proof of stake, the various versions of proof of stake. And like I say, there's a lot of pros and cons with each of them. But we've got to remember as well that these are experiments at the end of the day. Like some of these have only been around for less than 10 years. So we really are working out, you know, what the security profiles are, what the scalability profiles are, how they affect decentralization. But, you know, the golden kind of thing you have to keep in mind is the idea of the blockchain trilemma that Jack has talked about multiple times now, that you can only choose two of the three of scalability, security, and decentralization. So we are starting to see these blockchains actually position themselves in certain areas where some are known for scalability, some are known for security, and some are known for decentralization. But yeah, there's lots to do. Like I say, there's lots of things we could talk about, like advanced ZKPs and layer twos and all the things that are building on consensus algorithms. But maybe that's for another episode. So I just want to thank you all for listening, and thank you wherever you may be, and join us next time as we untangle a little more of Web3. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.